This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
rescue workers have been searching for flood victims amid thousands of calls for help and floodwaters that continue to rise, damaging homes, businesses, and infrastructure.
That's VOA's Jim Randall reporting on the latest on what is now Tropical Storm Harvey and its economic impact on Southeast Texas. Details coming up.
Also, since returning from sick leave in Britain this month, Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari chaired his first cabinet meeting today, and the International Organization for Migration reports no migrants have died while crossing the Mediterranean Sea over the past 20 days.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari chaired his first cabinet meeting today since returning from sick leave in Britain this month. Buhari returned to Nigeria on August 19th after more than 3 months in London for treatment for an undisclosed ailment. Last week, he canceled a cabinet meeting, raising concerns from his opponents who say they feared that the president was returning to his former ways when he worked from home and missed weekly cabinet meetings. The refusal to disclose details of Buhari's illness has caused speculation about whether the 74-year-old is well enough to run Africa's most populous country and biggest economy.
The International Organization for Migration reports no migrants have died while crossing the Mediterranean Sea over the past 20 days. It adds migrant fatalities in general appear to be on the decline. Lisa Schlein reports from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
The central Mediterranean Sea route from Libya to Italy is much favored by African migrants who risk their lives on smugglers' boats desperate to reach Europe. While this route might become a gateway to a better life for some, it also is notorious for taking the lives of many. The International Organization for Migration reports a total of 2,410 Mediterranean Sea fatalities this year. IOM spokesman Leonard Doyle says it is remarkable to go without a single reported death for 20 days. He acknowledges it is very hard to know exactly why.
The flows from Libya have diminished. If you recall, in July there were days when 3,000 people were picked up in one weekend. You remember that? And now we have very, very few. So something's happening. We're not sure what's behind it all. We see somewhat of a decline of the migrant flows coming in from Niger, but not enough to justify or to explain why the flows across the Mediterranean have gone down.
IOM data show the number of fatalities on the Mediterranean Sea generally has declined. Just 19 deaths have been recorded across the region this month, which is a sharp drop from the 689 recorded in August 2015 and 62 last year. Doyle says no deaths for 20 days might be a cause for celebration. He warns, though, this number can easily go up as smugglers continue to prey on vulnerable migrants, risking their lives while exploiting them for profit. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. President Donald Trump yesterday visited Southeast Texas, which continued to be battered by the remnants of Hurricane Harvey. Trump's visit was part of an effort to show the federal government's responsiveness to the storm, which now has dumped historic amounts of rain and left at least 20 people dead, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports.
Hurricane Harvey, now the rainiest tropical storm in U.S. history. Houston has now seen 125 centimeters of rain, according to the National Weather Service. Water is everywhere, overflowing dams, filling streets, and taking over houses. Authorities have rescued thousands, many from the roofs of their homes. Others fled on foot, carrying as many personal belongings as they could to crowded evacuation centers on higher ground. On Tuesday, President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania Trump visited the region, where they were briefed by local leaders on rescue and recovery efforts.
We won't say congratulations. We don't want to do that. You know, we don't want to congratulate. We'll congratulate each other when it's all finished, but you have been terrific.
Trump, later addressing supporters gathered outside, was optimistic.
I will tell you, this is historic. It's epic what happened. But you know what? It happened in Texas, and Texas can handle anything. Thank you all, folks.
Trump has taken care to portray a hands-on leadership during what is the first natural disaster of his administration. But it's still too early to assess the government response, as the worst is likely yet to come. Forecasters expect days more of rain to hit Houston, and floodwaters aren't expected to crest until later this week. Once the waters recede, the death toll is expected to increase as authorities begin searching house to house. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Washington.
Rebuilding efforts in areas devastated by Hurricane Harvey's winds and floods face higher costs and some delays because the construction industry has a critical shortage of skilled workers. Construction problems add to the growing economic impact of closed airports, seaports, retail stores, and vital oil industry facilities. VOA's Jim Randall reports.
Rescue workers have been searching for flood victims amid thousands of calls for help and floodwaters that continue to rise, damaging homes, businesses, and infrastructure. The massive job of rebuilding Houston and other areas Harvey hammered will cost more and take longer because there is already a shortage of skilled construction workers like carpenters and bricklayers and of skilled people to manage projects. The Associated General Contractors of America found the skills shortage hit 70% of their members. Ken Simonson is the chief economist.
In many cases, it means delay, that it will take longer because companies that are hiring subcontractors can't find ones willing to bid, or the subcontractors say, we'll get to it after we've done this job.
Simonson says construction jobs have evolved from pick and shovel work to high-tech tools like GPS and lasers. His industry is urging schools to offer more classes in construction skill. The storm has caused major damage to important assets. But a Cornell University expert says economic tools measure the impact poorly because they count rebuilding efforts as an economic boost, missing the cost of losses. Business professor Stephen Kyle.
So in order to really get a handle on this, you would have to know what all of the houses, machinery, buildings, roads, what they're worth. And to be honest, we really won't know what all of that damage is until we actually go in and try and rebuild.
Oil infrastructure is vital to the economy, and Kyle says whatever was damaged will be rebuilt quickly because companies need revenue from the facilities. Disruptions are still expected to raise the cost of gasoline in the United States by as much as 6.5 cents a liter, at least for a while. Houston is the fifth largest U.S. container port. According to data analysis firm Panjiva, the storm stalls the thousands of containers that usually move through Houston daily, carrying auto parts and other goods. Oil shipments are also blocked. In normal times, Houston's airports handle 1,600 or more flights per day, but they are currently closed by foul weather. Jim Randall, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up on 14 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The Malawi government has launched a national policy which seeks to regulate and control alcohol consumption. The move started 10 years ago, but was delayed following resistance from breweries, which had been challenging the draft policy. A recent survey by the World Health Organization on non-communicable diseases shows that 20% of all Malawians consume alcohol. It also indicates that 1 in 5 men drink too much. Medical experts say too much alcohol consumption affects human health and also the country's development. Nelson Zakeyu is a national coordinator for Malawi Alcohol Policy Alliance. He speaks with Lamek Messina about the issues the alcohol policy seeks to address.
In fact, the aim is actually to work on the demand and supply of alcohol. I would like to see that alcohol is not easily accessible, and it is not also very cheap.
So what does the policy seek to address?
The policy identifies the gaps within and among the existing laws in the country You know, in Malawi, we have existing laws. There's the Consumer Protection Act. There's also the Taxation Act and the Liquor Licensing Act. All these acts were actually enacted in 1979. So you can see that they are outdated. So the police seeks a review of all these existing policies because it is also realized that they are all disjointed. So the National Alcohol Police would like to harmonize all these existing legislations. There's also another area which is very, very important. That is the marketing of alcohol products. You know, some of the advocates from this industry, they actually attract young people to start consuming. For example, the adverts that actually associate alcohol to notable athletes. Another issue is that you see when they're advertising, they sometimes associate alcohol with beautiful ladies. So you may wonder what is the motive behind all these things. All these acts of adverts are not all that good. National Alcohol Police would like to see that adverts are done in ethical manners.
We understand that the push for the policy started almost maybe 10 years ago. Why the delay?
Yes, the policy has taken a long time for it to be actually approved. The initial time when the policy started to be developed, there was a need to ask people to have their ideas inputted into the National Alcohol Policy. There was also need of consulting with all those concerned. But then we had a problem of interferences from commercial interests. That played a very, very big setback for the policy to be approved. But like enough, now we have a National Alcohol Policy approved.
What was the argument of the breweries?
The idea for interference from the alcohol industry was probably to control the National Alcohol Policy. They wanted to take lead in the development of the policy so that they probably not tackle the main issues that are actually recommended by WHO to address the evils of harmful consumption of alcohol.
Yeah, you have said that one of the problems, the drawback was because of the breweries were resisting the policy. So what efforts have you taken to convince the breweries that they have to abide by the dictates of the policy?
For your own information, let's understand it very, very clearly that the owners of the policy is the government. So there's no need that we can probably push those people who are making their trades in the country. Let me also inform you that during the initial development of the policy, we had an idea of working in collaboration with them so that although WHO says that we don't need to involve them, but we thought it was that they should be consulted, not necessarily in the way that they should probably twist the National Alcohol Policy to their needs, but that they should know that in the country there's the National Alcohol Policy which was being developed. I'm happy now to report that with this policy in place, the alcohol industry seems to be well prepared to work with the government and all stakeholders in the implementation of the policy.
Do you think the battle is won?
I cannot say that the battle is won, because I feel that there are several things that need to be implemented, and it requires all stakeholders to join hands with the government to make sure that the policy is implemented. So we feel that the government will go ahead probably to come up with a law, a national alcohol law, that should clearly indicate the opening hours and closing hours of alcohol drinking places in the country. Because we'd like to see Malawi to move with the world. Because in other countries, you cannot see a person drinking while it is 8 in the morning. But what is happening in Malawi? People started drinking at 6 a.m., which is very, very bad.
Nelson Zakiyu is a national coordinator for Malawi Alcohol Policy Alliance. He was speaking with Lamech Messina in Blantyre.
In Zimbabwe, the pro-government Herald newspaper recently reported a shortage of life-saving HIV drugs. It cited challenges with importing the drugs. Reporter Kudzai Zanawashi looks into the matter, as well as recent reports of a new drug-resistant form of the virus that causes AIDS.
Recent local media reports say the government is struggling to restock antiretroviral drugs that have been saving the lives of HIV-positive Zimbabweans. Dr. Owen Mugurungi is the director of the AIDS and Tuberculosis Unit in the Ministry of Health.
The element of truth and aftruth, the correct position is when our stock levels are excellent and good, we give people more than 3 months supply. And this helps to reduce the number of times that they come to the clinics. And when our stock levels are low, we then give you a month or less. There is no shortage of ARVs except this line. So the stock levels are low. So we have begun rationing so that nobody goes away without.
Mugurungi says the only drug in short supply is called Abacavir, which is also used to treat HIV and AIDS. He says the situation is under control and that the organization that facilitates treatment of the illness, the National AIDS Council, is expecting a series of consignments throughout the year.
There aren't many people out of the 1 million people on treatment. It's only 35,000 people who are receiving Abacavir. So the money to buy the second line Abacavir was coming from the National AIDS Council. So 6 months into the year, NAC has been struggling to get foreign currency.
Taurai Nyandoro is the national coordinator of a non-governmental organization called Zimbabwe AIDS Network. He says local production should be a priority.
So I think we need to put in place the right infrastructure and then, you know, identify entities whom we can then, you know, capacitate to produce, I mean, locally. It will solve a lot of problems. If we can do that as a country. I believe capacity is always there, but at times capacity is dormant. We need to exploit the capacity and then just to strengthen the capacity. I think we should then be able to produce locally. It's possible.
Local production may be crucial amid concerns of a new drug-resistant type of HIV. Dr. Rebecca Machidiso is the regional director of World Health Organization.
One of our key interventions is to try to limit the spread of resistant HIV. So it emerges when people are not consistent in taking their treatment, and therefore the level of the drugs in the blood goes down and drug-resistant virus, in this case, emerges. It is true that the second-line drugs are extremely expensive. I think that the issue of drug resistance is a big concern generally, not only for HIV but for other diseases as well. The fact that research and development of new drugs is not keeping up with the emerging resistance, and when these drugs are available initially, they're extremely costly.
Some people with HIV have stopped taking antiretroviral drugs after saying they received a prophecy telling them they are healed. This and other factors means second-line drugs are needed to fight the virus. They are more expensive and are covered by donors or taxpayers. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
After many years of embracing cuisine from other parts of the world, South Africans are finally learning to appreciate the food and recipes of their home continent. Eateries serving the traditional taste of Africa are springing up across countries. Finally, it's fashionable in South Africa to enjoy African food. From Tanzanian Mtuzi wa Samaki, or fish curry, to West African beef, plantain, or an okra stew, Ethiopian dishes are proving to be particularly popular. Darren Taylor reports on South Africa's belated discovery of Africa's rich culinary heritage.
A customer pays for a meal at the Abyssinia restaurant in southern Johannesburg. Patrons sit on cushions covered with multicolored embroidered cloth, at tables woven from grass. Intense aromas waft from the kitchen. Almost 20 years ago, Amsale Debela walked from Addis Ababa to the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya. She says she had to leave Ethiopia because her family opposed the state's anti-democratic policies. Her brother, Ermias, interprets her words.
The arresting for my father and the arresting also my sister.
Amsale's objective was to reach South Africa.
From Kenya and Tanzania, across with the ships from Dar es Salaam to Mutwara, the border of Mozambique and Tanzania. After Mozambique, we are crossing with a load, with a truck. We are sleeping in the bush.
The lorry ferried her and other migrants into Swaziland. Amsale remembers being dressed in rags. In Swaziland, fellow Ethiopians clothed, fed her, and helped her onto a bus to Johannesburg. In the city, a friend gave her 150 rand, today worth little more than $10, to buy goods to sell in the streets.
And I starting to selling for the toothbrush and the wallet and the belts. Now I get the small shop I'm running for my business. Thanks, God.
Amsale makes her journey from Ethiopian refugee to hawker in Johannesburg to owner of a successful restaurant sound easy. But she worked the streets for 15 years to save enough to open her business.
She have a lot of customers, Ethiopians, Kenyans, some white peoples. Now also the South African people also they came and they enjoy for our traditional foods. Thank you.
Abyssinia's cooks prepare Ethiopian dishes, hot berbere or chili doro wat chicken casserole and kiwat beef stew. The top sellers, though, are the tibs, sliced and spiced lamb, goat or beef, pan-fried in garlic, onion and tomato. Many dishes are favored liberally with niter kebe, spiced butter. The saucy concoctions are mopped up by hand with injera, spongy pancakes made from teff grain. Amsale rounds off the food she serves with world-famous Ethiopian coffee. She's proud of her achievements, but life remains tough in South Africa's biggest metropolis, especially for African immigrants. A few years ago, robbers surrounded Amsale at an intersection in the city center.
When I crossing there, three guys take out the gun without nothing, even in my pocket. I wasn't having 20 rand for the transportation. They want to take him for my life. Some of them, they have the knife.
Her sister and assistant, Rose, says she understands that criminals everywhere target people for money. But she can't grasp why some South Africans discriminate against the Debalas simply because they're immigrants.
Some people, you know, they say so, go back home. This is not your land. This is our land. And they're swearing us, you are foreigners. You're eating our money. You're taking our wife. I don't know why they're hating us. But it's fine. Still, we are alive.
The Debala Eatery is indeed a place where people come to celebrate the joy of being alive. But with tears in his eyes, Ermia says he and his sisters dream of returning to their relatives in Ethiopia.
We are eating together. We are sharing the church together. That's why I miss Addis. I miss my home. I miss my nation. I don't have any words to explain. Yeah.
Amsale and Rose say they appreciate each morsel they prepare for guests because they recall going weeks without food when they were fleeing Ethiopia. As Amsale puts it, people can hate you, they can jail you, but there is nothing as bad as hunger. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues and conflict resolution. Take your peek. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.